Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Ben Rylan. This week we're at the cinema for the brand new film A Star Is Born. This is the directorial debut for the actor Bradley Cooper, but hold your gasps. It's not the first time the story has made it to the screen. The first film to hold the title premiered way back in 1937, but even that was a loose and crucially unofficial reworking of an earlier picture. The two best known versions star Judy Garland, hailed as a masterpiece in 1954, and a, well, let's say disastrous remake in 1976 starring Barbara Streisand. This fifth installment sees Bradley Cooper take on directing and starring duties opposite Lady Gaga. It's been nearly 90 years since we first saw what's surely become Hollywood's ultimate rags-to-riches tale, but does it hold up? And how does Cooper fare in the director's chair? I'll ask the film critics Karen Krasanovich and Simran Hans whether a star really has been born. Karen and Simran, welcome to the program. Before we get started, let's go over the plot of A Star Is Born. Just in case you missed all of the previous iterations, I can't imagine how, Bradley Cooper stars as the hard-drinking megastar musician Jackson Maine, who meets and falls in love with a younger singer, Ally, played by Lady Gaga. Ally is just about to give up on her dreams, but Jackson, riding in like Prince Charming in a somewhat unlikely meet-cute in a drag bar, encourages her to look deeper into her creative spirit. Privately, however, he's staring down his share of demons in the shape of a few too many whiskey bottles.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Okay.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they like the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
Okay, Cameron, Simran, so many things to discuss in this film because, look, I'll be honest, when I heard that this film was coming, and it's been coming for a long time, It's been through development hell, they might call it in the industry, I had the expectation that when it eventually came, it would be some sort of glorified Disney Channel sop fest, a bit glittery, a bit, you know, fun, but nothing too serious, and wow, I was wrong. First impressions, Karen.
I'm just glad Clint Eastwood isn't directing it, which was on the cards for a long time. Although with Beyonce, you thought, well, that's not such a bad idea. But when I heard that Bradley Cooper was doing it, I thought, okay, you know. Then the minute Lady Gaga was on board, I thought, this is going to be interesting.
Really? So you thought this is going to be interesting. Simran, what were your impressions when you heard of how this film had actually culminated into what it has become? Were you doubtful or perhaps somewhat hopeful?
I mean, listen, what is Bradley Cooper doing directing movies? He's so weird. When you think about the kind of movies that he's starred in as an actor over the last couple of years, there's really no consistency. I can't quite figure him out and I don't understand what he's doing. And remember, he was in Burnt, the sort of chef movie that bombed. He was the raccoon in Guardians of the Galaxy. He kind of was a rom-com hero, but it never really took off for him. So, yeah, of course I was skeptical because I didn't understand. I didn't understand what his stake in the material was. I didn't see him as somebody who could possibly be a competent director. So I'm pretty surprised at how he pulls this off. And I think, yeah, a lot of it is down to Lady Gaga.
Just staying on Bradley Cooper there for a moment, because it is, you do make a good point, Simran, that it does come at an interesting time for Cooper. And from what I can ascertain, Cooper was sort of playing the studio playbook for a while there. He was starring in the Hangover films. He graduated from Alias on television with Jennifer Garner quite a few years ago now. And sort of he did what he had to do. And then there was all the critical acclaim and the Oscar glory that came from American Sniper. And that was what really opened the gate for him and allowed him to really handpick whatever he wanted to do. I suppose the bigger question is, why on earth did he choose this?
I guess I should backtrack a little bit and say it was maybe being unfair, kind of still associating him with things like he's just not that into you, when actually he had a successful spate of films working with David O. Russell, and Silver Linings Playbook was a big film for him. And maybe kind of as he's advanced in his career and worked with more auteur directors, maybe that's where he kind of got a flavour for the kind of idea that he wanted to act.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who
act,
has... Act and direct, indeed. And I think we can't underestimate just how brave taking on this project is, because even though it has been remade so many times and it may seem a bit predictable, the fact that it is so familiar and that a film is coming out in 2018 starring Lady Gaga called A Star Is Born, I mean, that's... On the face of it, it's just so corny, so syrupy, and it looks like something that would be a surefire, you know, bomb. I mean, I expected it not to be very good and to probably not do very well, but the way that it's come together is absolutely extraordinary.
One thing that you need for A Star Is Born is, across the board, a really super talented female who's genuinely talented.
You're right. It does rely on the presence of a superstar female. And I think for many people, that, of course, is why the 1954 version worked, because back then it was Judy Garland who had been written off by a lot of Hollywood. And this was her in huge, spectacular comeback. And a lot of people still now feel a bit sore that she didn't take away the Oscar that night. Were you surprised to see that Lady Gaga stepped into this film and not only sang and performed as we would expect Gaga to perform, but also shows herself to be a real, natural, amazingly talented actress?
She seemed vulnerable when she needed to be vulnerable, loving when she needed to be loving, and she kicked his ass when she needed to do it. But it was within her scope. And I think what's been interesting about her career is that, you know, mega stardom, but of course coming from humble roots, I suppose, but also having some health issues and having some career issues as well, maybe have shaped her a bit more to be an actress. And obviously, Cooper and she trust each other, which I think comes across on screen.
Simran, this obviously has a lot of music in it and relies very heavily on musical interludes, but it's not your maybe typical old-fashioned musical where they take place in some sort of fantasy, or there's really no explanation for everyone breaking into song, sort of like La La Land, if people are thinking of that. The music in this is happening in the real world. It's a music film. How do you think the film stacks up compared to other musicals in recent history?
Well, so I just wrote an article about this, actually, about the differentiation between musicals and sort of pop star movies. So a musical sort of delivers the narrative by way of the songs. So the plot is crowbarred into these kind of song and dance numbers. And in the pop star movie, you have opportunities created for the stars to sing and to dance or perform or whatever, but the story takes place around those moments, and they're kind of set up to feel more authentic. And I know they went to Coachella and filmed some of like the big stage scenes, and obviously Lady Gaga has been performing in arenas and stadiums for the best part of 10 years, so I think the way those sequences are kind of framed and shot, I think that's what gives them a veracity.
How important do you think, Simran, the music is to this film? I mean, really, the kind of music that they've decided to include in it, because some of it is quite serious. You know, we're not just talking about ballads here and uplifting pieces of music that you might expect on an episode of Glee. It does get quite serious, quite rock and roll at times as well, quite grungy, I suppose you could say.
This raises some really interesting questions about authenticity and stardom and how we're thinking about those concepts today in 2018. I think the Bradley Cooper character is sort of seen as old world. He's kind of country. He writes his own songs. He plays his own guitar. He doesn't even want to have the onstage in ears because he wants to really be there and like feel the authenticity of the crowd around him. And then he's very skeptical of what happens to the Lady Gaga character, Ali, when she gets signed by a major record deal, record label, and they kind of make her into more of a pop R&B starlet. And these two things are juxtaposed and, you know, seem to be fundamentally at odds with each other. I think the film is quite clever at not being overly moralistic about it, because the Lady Gaga character seems to still retain a sense of authority and authorship over her music, even as she's being shaped in this very particular way. And though she's seen as a versatile songwriter who's able to adapt to the different types of role that they want her to play within the industry, and it's the Bradley Cooper character who's sort of aging, fading, failing. So I think it handles that tension quite well, but also it's gendered. This male country rock star versus this female pop star. They're seen as two separate things.
Yeah, two opposing forces, I suppose, even though they don't want to be opposing. Both of them seem to want to be travel on this road together at the same time, and yet their timings are just all off. Karen, it is interesting matching up those two stories there, because you do have the, as Simran says, the male character who seems to have this view that the musical journey that Gaga's character takes isn't a serious one. And I'm not sure. I mean, I saw the film with some others, and we all came out with their own sort of take on what the film was trying to say. And I suspect maybe Simran is right that the film is not actually making the final judgment on any of this, and that's really up to the eye of the beholder. But there is that question, isn't there, of whether you can embark on a pop music career and still maintain your serious artistic credentials.
Well, I think there's a shift between old time country and new time pop. Obviously, because she's singing country at first, she slides into pop. And I think because she's shaped and changed by her manager, her hairstyle changes, her performing on stage changes, I think that the Jackson Maine character sees her as selling out, and he wants her to maintain what he found first at that drag club. And I think that she's saying, but you know, you've had your fame, I want to have this, but I still love you and I will shape my career toward you, which I thought was very interesting and very loving of them. But I think there definitely is a clash between what you have to do in the industry to make it and what you used to have to do to make it.
And Simran, that message, it's impossible to see that message in the film without taking into account the fact that we have Lady Gaga playing this role, and we have someone who started out her musical career as Stephanie Germanotta and then created this illusion that we now see as Lady Gaga, something that is very intentionally over the top and silly, but it is very, very carefully crafted by the clever artist behind the name Lady Gaga.
Well, it's very interesting to me that when the credits roll in the film, she's billed as Lady Gaga and not as Stephanie Germanotta. She's built all these layers of artifice, and then in her latest album, Joanne, she was stripped back. She wasn't wearing the wigs. She didn't have the meat dress. She didn't have the sort of any of the pageantry, and she did this sort of country rock album. And this seems a continuation of that persona. But what I think Gaga is doing is telling us that it's still a persona. You know, there's not an authentic Lady Gaga. She's all of these things. I think that's one of the sort of smartest things that the film does.
The core of this film seems to be trying to get to the truth of something, because that's what Bradley Cooper's role, Jackson Maine, he's always talking about. Get to the truth of whatever you're trying to say. And if you can speak the truth, then people will be listening, but they won't be listening forever. It's in some ways ironic, I suppose, that we do have these two major stars in this film, and at least in the beginning of the film, they're not looking so great. Lady Gaga is certainly all stripped back. She doesn't really look like herself. She's got the scraggly hair and she's not wearing any makeup. And Bradley Cooper looks about 10 or 15 years older than he actually is. And he's talking like Willie Nelson. Do you think, Karen, it is part of the illusion, isn't it, that we can have major Hollywood stars. We know that they're headed for glory, at least one of them is. And yet they're stripping themselves back and maybe trying to make themselves look more relatable by making themselves look terrible in an artificial way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a classic story, and the story is, it's never been older successful woman meets young dude. You know, that hasn't happened yet. But, I mean, don't forget, he was coached by Willie Nelson's son, I believe.
That's right. Willie Nelson's son is, it's his band, I think, that actually plays all the music in the film.
But I think it's culturally acceptable for an older man to take on a young acolyte as his lover and as his project, I suppose. And I'm not sure. I mean, I hoped it would be fine either way. Actually, what would be a really interesting Star is Born is if Jackson Maine falls in love with one of the drag queens instead of her at the club. But I digress.
I was really I was rooting for that, actually.
Yeah, the Dolly Parton one I like.
It felt as though Willem was quite tempted, certainly gave it a red-hot go.
But I think it's a classic story of woman being rescued and eclipsing her rescuer. And I think that we like that because we like the underdog to succeed. We like talent to be exposed.
And somehow it comes across as not, as far as I can tell, as not being in any way sexist at all, because at no point does it feel as though Gaga's character is relying on Bradley Cooper's character at all. She's succeeding with her own merits, completely of her own drive.
Absolutely. And also, she's looking after him. He needs her. She needs him. And it seems quite genuine. That was the nice thing. That didn't really look... There may have been some sniping and some insulting, but it felt real.
Well, I think the tinnitus subplot for the Bradley Cooper character, he's got this problem where he's hearing this ringing in his ears because he's not looking after himself, as he's been playing music on stage for decades. And there's this subplot that his ability to play is in jeopardy. And so I think that's kind of way around the power dynamic. I think it makes the stakes a little bit more even between the two of them. So it's not just the alcoholism, but it's this other disease that is debilitating for him in a way.
Simran, one of the things I felt was going into this was that this story is about 90 years old, right? And it on the face of it, it's already camp because we've seen the poster. It has that glittery writing. It instantly brings up images of Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand, and of course it's called A Star Is Born, which in 2018 is kind of a silly name for a movie. But I was struck by how seriously the film seems to take itself. And perhaps, as Karen, you mentioned earlier, Bradley Cooper does take himself quite seriously. Maybe that's got a bit to do with it. But did you, when you sat down to watch the film, how long were you sitting there before you started to feel as though this is a serious movie? Or did you feel like that at all?
30 seconds, easily. The tone is established immediately that this is a serious Hollywood melodrama. It's a prestige film. And once that clicked for me, once I understood what kind of film it was, I was so excited. I love that kind of movie. And they don't really get made anymore, you know? These kind of high stakes, high drama, glossy, big budget Hollywood movies for grown-ups, they just don't get made. And, you know, unless they're franchised, and I guess in a way this sort of is, although it feels like a standalone thing. So, yeah, that clicked for me immediately. And I think that's why it's successful, because if they don't play it completely straight, if they don't make it serious, then the film has no stakes and you're not really rooting for anyone.
I was sitting there waiting and I thought, you know, I love the concept and I already love the story. And I thought it's going to fall down on two different things for me. I'm not going to like the songs, right? If I don't like the songs, then you've lost me. Number two, I'm not going to believe the relationship or the arc of fame. And actually, I heard Shallow, and I thought, wow, all my music theory came back. I only like this because they're repeating the phrases. But I love the central song. And so I was sold from that moment.
And
absolutely.
That moment in the film is so kind of powerful because it's this real high point of catharsis. And you know, the song is co-written by Lady Gaga and Mark Ronson. It's a big power ballad pop song, and the way it just explodes, it feels real. It feels like a real pop song. It doesn't feel like a song written for a movie. It feels like a song you might hear on the radio. So that's why it works. It feels authentic.
Well, we like to talk about the things that you were reminded of in this program when you saw the film in question. So, Karen, when you approached this, you were instantly taken back to the Johnny Cash biopic that came out way back in 2005. Gosh, another lifetime ago, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon. What brought that to mind?
Was I alive then? Jeez.
I certainly wasn't.
I think it was the train wreck that he was, and how her career was going, how she was trying to look after him, but the fact that they were almost welded together. It's just one of those things where it's terrible, but they're together and it's terrible. And you know that something bad's going to happen, but they love each other so much that, and it felt very authentic. And obviously that was based on a true story. But I just like the fact that love doesn't have to be shiny and squeaky. It can also go through the bad places.
And again, we've got a film that was an absolute acting powerhouse. Mm-hmm. Joaquin Phoenix, Reese Witherspoon, and Simran, they were both using their real voices when they made that film, as we see again in A Star Is Born. I mean, that Walk the Line, that was real. That was an Oscar darling when that came out. Are you predicting the same for A Star Is Born?
I think it will definitely be nominated for a lot of things, and I think it could probably win quite a lot of awards as well. It's hard to know sort of this early in the season when we haven't seen everything else, so there could be other things coming out that might eclipse it. But I think Walk the Line makes sense to me as something that you thought of, because that was the last time that I can think of, really, that a musical really swept those awards, unless we count La La Land, but it's a very different kind of film. I mean, this kind of serious musical melodrama. So I can see how you would think of both of them in tandem with each other.
Do you think this will be, look, Walk the Line was obviously 2005, that was some time ago, and it wasn't necessarily, the success of that film wasn't necessarily enough to convince everyone that musically driven films can actually be serious films as well. They don't just have to be Chicago or La La Land. Do you think the success of this film will be enough to show that actually, you know, a film can be fun, musically minded, but also a serious powerhouse drama?
I mean, there have been other examples of films that have tried to be both musical and serious, and some of them just aren't good. I'm thinking of Dreamgirls specifically, which was also nominated for a lot of awards, but is actually tragically terrible. Even though I've
oh no, oh that's a controversial point.
I've seen it weirdly a lot of times, and every time I'm like, yeah, I could watch this, and then it's about 3 hours long and it's so boring, and Jennifer Hudson is incredible and Beyonce can't really act, she's super stiff in the film, and I think that stiffness is maybe what hinders it from really kind of taking flight in the way that A Star Is Born does.
I'm reminded of that film mostly because of that absolutely wonderful performance by Jennifer Hudson. Now that you mention it, not a lot of the rest of the film was that memorable. Maybe I need to see it on stage.
But, there are others. There's Ray with Jamie Foxx that won him some awards as well. I think this is a format that exists, but it just hasn't really been reignited in a while. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why an appetite for that kind of film has died down.
I think it's very difficult to make a good movie anyway, but I think getting the music right and getting the pace right, getting the content of that music right, and the sound. I mean, the lyrics have to be good for me, and the sound. And I just think that's very, very costly. I mean, we know how much it is to get Hans Zimmer in, but you've got to be so careful with that because people are so sensitive to it.
Zimmerman, though, another film that sprung to mind for you when we were talking about this was The Bodyguard. Now, speaking of singers who have crossed over into acting territory, this film gave us Whitney Houston's acting debut. And of course, her take on Dolly Parton's classic, I Will Always Love You. Aside from the obvious comparisons here, what about this film brought to mind The Bodyguard?
Well, they're both starring a major pop star as a kind of fictionalized version of themselves. I mean, it's much more the case in The Bodyguard that Whitney Houston's Rachel Maron is basically Whitney Houston. And, you know, it has all these incredible original songs. I mean, I Will Always Love You is a cover, and she really made that song, although I like the Dolly Parton version as well. But, you know, there's a whole album of music from The Bodyguard, which we just think of as Whitney Houston. We think of it as a Whitney Houston album, stuff like Queen of the Night. I can't remember the specifics of whether some of that was repurposed from other albums that she'd done or how it was released. But in any case, the soundtrack to The Bodyguard was record-breaking. It was the biggest-selling soundtrack album ever. I think that I wish I could remember the statistic off the top of my head, but it's something like the first soundtrack album to sell more than a million copies in a week or something. I mean, in 1992, I guess that
makes sense.
That makes sense.
Absolutely, it's the song that you hear over and over again. But Karen, like it or not, The Bodyguard is one of those films that we always turn back to. We always find referenced in today's culture. It's obviously a classic, but it's also in today's pop culture vernacular not usually taken that seriously. It often kind of gets lumped into this tearjerker bracket. I'm thinking of films like Steel Magnolias or Beaches. These films that are considered women's weepies and people don't really take them that seriously. Is that unfair?
Well, I mean, do you really believe that Kevin Costner is going to carry her out? I don't know. I mean, it seemed very, very corny. It was held together by amazing moments of music, which is great. Yeah, I think because it is such a cliche, And also, it's spared, it's kept clean, I suppose, by the fact that, spoiler alert, they don't sleep together. Or at least we assume we don't.
They do.
Oh, do they really?
I don't know if you remember, but there's a seduction scene involving a shot of Whitney Houston throwing her silk scarf in the air and it landing on Freudian slip, on Kevin Costner's samurai sword in his apartment, and it just slices
actually,
in half.
I do remember that, but I just thought, wow, she shouldn't really go over by that sword thing. I guess I didn't read in enough to it. But it's wholesome and it's exciting, but it is, I think, at this point, quite clunky. I don't think it's really aged very well.
I actually have to beg to differ on that. I'm sorry. I'm still trying to get over the visual of the silk scarf on the sword.
You know the bit I mean, right?
I do. It's slipped my mind. I remember it now.
I wish I'd remembered it before we sat down to do this show. We could have devoted a whole segment just to that. I do think that's slightly unfair because even though the aesthetic of The Bodyguard has been lumped into this cliched bracket within our minds, I do think that section of film, that part of the video shop as it might have been in the 90s, it's dreadfully underappreciated because even in films that we tend to take a little bit more seriously, films like this are referenced over and over again, aren't they, Simran? And I say, in some ways, you can say that A Star Is Born is also referencing that style of film too.
I think so. And I think it's, for me, the last significant example of this sort of musical melodrama, this prestige melodrama that we were discussing before. And you have to remember, it's written by a big Hollywood guy, Lawrence Kasdan, who did the script for stuff like the Star Wars movies. He did The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi. He did Body Heat, the sort of incredibly sexy 70s movie, film noir. And so people have an idea of him as someone who's a very successful Hollywood screenwriter, and then this film kind of got panned at the time. But I think it's, you know, it has that quality of those 90s movies where films of this budget and scale were being churned out, and really the infrastructure has changed for that kind of film. They're not really being made anymore.
When I saw A Star Is Born, I wasn't in a press screening. I was with the general public, if you can believe that. And I was sitting there, and the cinema was full. And at the end of the movie, everyone clapped. That doesn't usually happen when I go to a public screening. I was quite surprised by that. And then I looked around and realized there's actually not just one kind of person here. They're not all women. They're not all men. They're not all young. They're not all old. It seemed to be quite a mixed bag. And even if you look at the film, it feels as though it's not aiming just at one person. It's aiming itself at a very wide audience. Is that a good thing, Karen?
That has to be. It's the evolution of Hollywood, that corporations are basically taking the storytelling to try and maximize their profits. And it's not necessarily because they need to, although they say they need to. Now they need to break into something that's going to go across markets. And that's what they're hoping A Star Is Born is going to do. I mean, look, it's been around for 90 years. It's still working.
Yeah, it is definitely still working. Simran, do you think this is going to break barriers? It's going to appeal to everyone?
Hopefully any good Hollywood movie is trying to do that and is trying to cut across a broad swathe of people. And so when we award them with Oscars, we're awarding a particular kind of film that is mainstream and that does have cross appeal. And I guess, you know, with the inclusion of the new sort of Best Popular Film Award, which I'm not really sold on, I think the Academy is trying to differentiate between these money and profit-focused popular films and sort of studio-based, big-budget or medium-sized but auteur-driven movies. It's hard to know how it will land, but I'm happy that people are going to see it.
I think it's going to shoot. Shoot for the stars. Indeed, A Star Has Been Born. That's the moral of today's story. And it brings us to the end of today's program. A Star Is Born is, of course, out in cinemas now, hopefully absolutely everywhere. Thanks to my guests today, Simran Hans and Karen Krizanovich, and, of course, to my producer, our very own star, Holly Fisher. Join us next week when we'll be heading down to the Strand here in London for a new exhibition called Strange Days, Memories of the Future, a new video art collaboration between The Vinyl Factory and New York's New Museum. Until then, from me, Ben Ryland, thank you for listening.